and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the response to President Trump's State of the Union from the designated Democrat, not to mention other opposition voices who weighed in, and speak with Paul Waldman, a senior writer at the American Prospect and author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success, about his article at The Washington Post, What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. He joins us to discuss how Democrats should resist the call by centrist pundits to reach out to conservative voters, but instead energize and mobilize voters to vote in November using the growing and palpable anger across the land at Trump, which is shared by 57% of the country who feel he is reckless, profane, and sexist, together with the alarm 46% of Americans feel who believe Trump is a greater danger to America and the world than North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Then we'll look into one of the more glaring lies in Trump's hour-and-a-half-long string of jingoistic patriotic platitudes mixed in with hyper-salesmanship, and focus on his claim that, quote, Apple has just announced it plans to invest a total of $350 billion in America and hire another 20,000 workers. This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. Economist, lawyer, investigative journalist James Henry, the co-founder of the new investigative reporting service DCReport.org, joins us to discuss Trump's massive giveaway to the 1% dressed up as middle-class tax relief and his bogus infrastructure plan, which is based on a disastrous experiment that rewarded contractors but failed miserably for the public in the UK. Then finally, we'll look into the healthcare project put forward by Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway that is long on promises and short on details, and speak with Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times, about his article at the Los Angeles Times, Reducing Healthcare Costs Doesn't Require Bezos, Buffett, Diamond Magic. Every other country already knows how. We'll try to analyze why so many Republicans cheered Donald Trump at last night's State of the Union when he proudly announced he was taking health care away from millions of his fellow Americans. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post's Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at the American Prospect. The author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
So, of course, Joe Kennedy's was the official Democratic rebuttal. There were other, I guess, voices of the resistance who also spoke. But by and large, Joe Kennedy seemed to get pretty good reviews. And I know that people talked about his lip balm, as you point out, and trivial things. But in general, you know, we've seen some pretty pathetic rebuttals from Bobby Jindal in Louisiana and Marco Rubio, Swilling Water. So how would you rate, I know I'm lowering the bar, Paul, but how would you rate Joe Kennedy?
Well, it was quite good. Maybe not the best ever, but I think one thing they did that was really smart is they put him in front of an audience. You know, ordinarily what happens is the president comes out in front of Congress with all this kind of pageantry, and then you get some guy sitting alone in a quiet room talking to the camera. It works much better. Any speech works better if there's an audience to play off of. So that was smart. And I think that Kennedy's speech was quite well written, and it was a really good kind of appeal to fundamental liberal values. And the reason I decided to write about it was because, you know, we've seen a lot of people giving advice to Democrats lately, as they often do. And one of the things you hear over and over again is that Democrats need to come up with an affirmative, positive agenda, that they can't just be against Trump. And if they just do that, then they're going to lose. Well, I don't think that's true at all. And because we're coming up to a midterm election, and I can go into all the reasons why, but I think that that in a midterm election, being just against Trump is not only the politically smart thing to do, it's also the morally righteous thing to do.
Well, of course, as you point out, conservative and centrist pundits are saying that the wise thing would be to reach out to the center and even disaffected conservatives. But one of the problems, or the asymmetry, if you will, between the Democrats and the Republicans is always that the Republicans manage to get every last one of their voters out, whereas Democrats, as Barack Obama once mentioned about midterms, seem to have a genetic problem with voting in midterms. So it really is a question of, in spite of the Republican gerrymandering, if enough Democrats show up in November, which they normally don't do, then they will sweep and the blue wave will become a reality. But they always lack the inspiration. My sense is that it's palpable out there, the anger, the frustration. You just have to look at the polls. Majorities of Americans are just disgusted. Some of them are alarmed. 46% of Americans believe that Trump is a greater danger than Kim Jong-un. And Trump spent an awful lot of time last night in the State of the Union demonizing the North Koreans, and it became clear to me from watching it that this guy really wants to go to war with North Korea.
You know, we're in an extraordinary political moment. I've never seen the Democratic base as activated as it is right now. You know, the indivisible movement has chapters in every single congressional district in America, many chapters in many districts. You've got thousands of people who have signed up to run for office, and it's all based on anger at Donald Trump. And you can make an argument that we've become so polarized that persuasion is now almost impossible, and mobilization is what's even going to win you presidential elections. But it's particularly true in midterm elections. What we always see is that the party that's more energized is the one that wins. And, you know, we had this pattern that people are probably familiar with, where in a president's first midterm election, his party almost always loses seats. And that's because when the president of one party gets elected, the opposition gets mad. And we've seen that over and over again. You know, why was it that Republicans took back Congress in 2010 and 2014? It was because they were angry at Barack Obama. And by the same token, when Democrats took Congress in 2006, they were angry at George W. Bush. So we see this in midterm election after midterm election. The party that's more mad is the one that has its people get motivated to get out and vote. Now, I should say that it's not that, you know, Democrats don't have a positive agenda. If you go to your local congressional candidate and you ask her, you know, what do you think about health care? What do you think about the minimum wage? What do you think about the environment? She'll be able to tell you all the positions she has. Democrats have nothing but policies. But in terms of, you know, what you want to focus on and what's really motivating people to get to the polls, it's those negative emotions that are directed at the president right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at the American Prospect, the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. But when you talk about Democratic anger, Paul, it seems that you're talking about the grassroots and the Democrats, or at least the Democratic establishment, in particular the DCCC, they always seem to run away from their base. They're looking for millionaires that can self-fund. There's some extraordinary examples of it happening out here in California. I mean, there's a guy that's running against Nunes, who I would think, you know, that would be one of the greatest acts of political necessity on the planet to get rid of that guy. His own hometown paper, the Fresno Bee, is basically implying that he might be a traitor and asking why is he going to bat for the Russians. But instead, the DCCC is backing some self-funder who his main positions are that he wants to bring back the death penalty and doesn't think Californians are sufficiently concerned about the Second Amendment, as opposed to a Latino in a largely Latino district in the Central Valley. So it's pretty amazing. And you've got Kyrsten Sinema running for the Senate in Arizona, who votes about 80% of the time with Republicans. She's likely to run against Martha McSally, a former A-10 fighter pilot, who, you know, if I was a voter in Arizona, I'd vote for the authentic Republican, not the imitation one. So there's a kind of lack of logic amongst the Democratic establishment that as long as you can get somebody elected with a D behind their name, you win. But if you got a bunch of centrist and conservative Democrats elected in these red-leaning states or red-leaning districts, they're not necessarily going to vote with you. And so what have you won?
Yeah, you know, the party in Washington doesn't always have a good sense of what is going to motivate voters. And that's particularly true of the DCCC. So, you know, the thing about what's happening right now on the Democratic side is that it's completely organic. You know, it isn't obviously the DNC is trying to do what they can to promote it. But, you know, the stuff that they try to do at a national level often just ends up not doing very much. You know, people might remember a couple of months ago when Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and some of the other Democratic leadership tried to come up with a message that would sort of synopsize everything Democrats stand for, and they came up with this thing called a better deal, and they had a sort of a lame event to unveil it, and nobody cares about it anymore at all. But at the same time, you have this organically growing activism that has come up. And, you know, Indivisible is a great example. It was a few people who were former congressional aides who put up something that was sort of a guide for people to how the best way to influence their members of Congress. And it just exploded into something that is a real national movement and is promoting candidates all over the place. And it's not because those people are necessarily geniuses. It's because there was such a desire out there and people were looking for a way to channel it. And so, you know, the Democratic Party and Democratic leaders in Congress can be extraordinarily successful this year, not through any of their own efforts necessarily. You know, they may end up becoming the majority in Congress just because of this thing that happened and because, frankly, of Donald Trump. Even if they, you know, the best thing that they can do is, to a certain extent, is just get out of its way.
Right, but that's the issue, isn't it? Whether the DCCC and the DNC will get out of its way. And somebody wants to, recently on this subject, mentioned what Abba Iban said about Arafat, that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, and how much that might apply to the Democrats. And, of course, we know that the really inspiring Democrat that Bernie Sanders and others wanted to head the DNC, Keith Ellison, who's a Muslim, didn't get the job, and Tom Perez did, and he was behind that New Deal, or what did they call it? Better Deal?
Better Deal.
Yeah, that really took off like a house on fire, didn't it? You know.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that obviously can be a problem, and one of the things that happens is when there's a contested primary, the DCCC will come in, and their only concern often is who can raise the most money. And then they'll back that person. And yeah, that can be a real issue. But maybe they'll learn some lessons from what's happening right now, and that the person with the biggest fundraising base isn't always the one who's going to be the most effective and be able to motivate the most voters. And that really is the most important thing right now, is what is going to get Democrats excited. And, you know, they're already excited to a great degree. And we saw that throughout 2017 in places like Virginia and New Jersey and all over the place, even where Democrats lost, you know, in races like in Montana and Kansas and places, they dramatically outperformed what they normally would have done in those districts and states. And so, you know, you're really seeing this extraordinary desire out there for people to get to the polls, as long as Democrats can avoid screwing it up.
So you mentioned in your article, Paul Waldman, what Joe Kennedy's speech says about Democratic anger at Trump. You mentioned earlier about what he said that was really sort of inspiring and going back to Democratic roots, if you will, reminding Democrats of what they stand for. Let's just play that clip from last night's speech by Joe Kennedy.
This administration isn't just targeting the laws that protect us. They're targeting the very idea that we are all worthy of protection. For them, dignity isn't something you're born with, but something you measure by your net worth, your celebrity, your headlines, your crowd size. Not to mention the gender of your spouse, the country of your birth, the color of your skin, the God of your prayers. Their record is a rebuke to our highest American ideal, the belief that we are all worthy, that we are all equal, that we all count. In the eyes of our law and our leaders, our God and our government. That is the American promise.
And that was Joe Kennedy and the Democratic rebuttal to Donald Trump's State of the Union speech last night. again, Paul, the idea that the Republicans are great at getting their people out to vote, every last one of them, the Democrats have a natural majority, but they usually fail to inspire people to get out to vote. Your main argument here is that the inspiration's already happened. It's just a question of whether the party establishment will get out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're right that it's the inspirational candidates who really motivate people. I mean, the highest turnout came when Barack Obama was running for president, and he was, you know, the most inspirational candidate Democrats have seen in a long time. And Democrats have often had a tendency to nominate for president people who are, you know, committed public servants with a long record of experience, but who aren't necessarily the most inspirational people. You know, candidates like Al Gore and Michael Dukakis and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. And we saw in 2016, Clinton made a concerted effort to reach out to moderate Republicans. The theory, which seemed perfectly sound at the time, was that Donald Trump was such an extreme candidate and so repellent to so many people that there would be moderate Republicans who would be willing to cross over and vote for her if she made an appeal to them. Well, you know, it made a lot of sense at the time, but it turned out to be wrong. What happened was that they weren't persuaded by her. And all of those moderate Republicans swallowed whatever kind of misgivings they had about Donald Trump and voted for him. He got the same amount of Republican votes as Mitt Romney had and just John McCain had. So, you know, there was no turn away from him from the Never Trumpers. There may have been some of them, you know, who are columnists and things like that, but as an electoral phenomenon, it was non-existent. And that tells us something about what kind of a partisan era we live in, that even a candidate like Donald Trump won't turn away people from his party. And in that kind of an environment, the next Democratic candidate has to know that, you know, any efforts they make to persuade Republicans to cross over for them are just not going to work. And so they have to inspire their own voters to get out and vote.
Well, but it seems like they still haven't learned from Hillary Clinton's mistakes of seeing Bernie Sanders as the enemy. I mean, for God's sake, the guy that they chose as the vice president didn't do a damn thing for that ticket. Bernie Sanders would have got her over the top with a big majority. Polls indicate that he probably, had he run against Trump, and this is some of Trump's own polling as well, says that he might have beaten Trump. So there's a peculiar resistance to, and he had already shown that you can inspire young people and blue-collar people to get out and support you in droves. And he had, you know, it was all self-funded. He didn't go to Wall Street. She raised $1.4 billion and lost to Trump, who raised about $861 billion. So that's where I wonder about what I fear is that the same kind of mentality that froze Bernie Sanders out rather than embrace him and be grateful for the fact that he was bringing new voters to the polls. Do you share that concern? I mean, it mystifies me.
Yeah, I think that there's an extent to which money stops making much of a difference after a certain point. You can't win like a congressional election if you have no money, or if you can only spend, you know, $20,000 on your campaign. It's just not going to be possible if you're coming up against somebody who's spending $1 million or $5 million. But past a certain point, it really doesn't matter if you're the person who can raise $3 million or you're the person who can raise $6 million. There's only so many ads you can buy, and ads have very small effects. But it's true that, you know, in places like the DCCC, they are very, very focused on how much advertising, how much television advertising you'll be able to buy. And they even have a contract that they sign with candidates, where they agree to give the candidate help, and in return, the candidate pledges to spend most of their money on advertising. And that's very good for the Democratic consultant class, who, by the way, will be recommended by the DCCC. They'll tell you what media consultants you should hire and what direct mail consultants you should hire. And so there's very much of a kind of a system there that makes sure that a lot of people make money, but it doesn't really privilege grassroots organizing. And so it's particularly important if we're in the kind of partisan era that we are, and what matters is getting people to the polls. You know, advertising doesn't do it. So you need that kind of a grassroots network. But, you know, that's also something that not every candidate can generate. So, but you know, the part of the problem is that that's a little harder for them to judge. You know, that somebody from Washington can drop into your district and say, how much do you have in your bank account? And then they can say, okay, well, you've got this much and the other person has that much, and so they're doing better than you. But it's a lot harder for them to assess whether you're really going to be able to generate the excitement that will, you know, put together a grassroots movement that will, you know, rise up over the course of the election. And because they can't tell whether that's going to happen, they decide that they're just going to go by the bank account.
But the other bizarre part about it is, and this is the other asymmetry between the Democrats and the Republicans, it looks like the Republicans have pretty effective campaign people, particularly the guy that did their digital for Trump. Whereas on the Democratic side, you have this pantheon of well-paid losers, going back to Susan Estrich, you know, Bob Schrum, who was Hillary's first guy in 2008.
Mark Penn.
Yeah, Mark Penn collected, I can't remember how many millions he collected for losing. Podesta, apparently, in this round of Hillary's, collected $25 million and lost. So that's the other part of the I mean, if you have to go back to Carville to find a Democratic Party operative that really is effective and is going to win. They're all...
Well, I would say that the people who ran Barack Obama's campaigns did a very good
exactly.
job.
Exactly.
And but, you know, also that came from the fact that the person who... That it was Obama himself who kind of did the best job of setting the tone and making some of the most important judgments that allowed that campaign right. to be as effective as it was, both in 2008 and 2012. So you know, there are those people out there,
right.
but there are also a lot of people who, you know, fail upward and keep losing and keep getting business because they know the right people.
Right, and that's what you were just saying, that not only do they select these self-starters and millionaires like this Qualcomm heiress down in Orange County who's bound to lose, you know, literally an airhead heiress, but she's a self-starter. So they're going to go with her against, I think, Dana Rohrabacher, who, again, it would be the Lord's work to get rid of him along with Devin Nunes. So it's an amazing situation. But it looks like the motivation's there, and I guess we should be grateful for that, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that for all the issues, this really does look like it's going to be a Democratic wave election, and you're not going to be able to stop all of those angry people from getting out to vote. So I think it's going to be very good for Democrats.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Paul Waldman.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at The American Prospect, the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into one of the more glaring lies in Trump's hour-and-a-half-long string of jingoistic patriotic platitudes mixed in with hyper-salesmanship at his State of the Union last night. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he is the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. And his latest article at DC Report is The Apple Tax Giveaway. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Glad to be with you.
And last night, amongst some of the more, I mean, basically Donald Trump's State of the Union was just a long hour and a half string of patriotic platitudes mixed in with hyper salesmanship. And of course, dutifully, the Republicans cheered at every moment. But the one thing that he really, the big howler, was when he talked about Apple investing $350 billion in America and another 20,000 workers, and then went on to say how this is our new American moment. There's never been a better time to start living the American dream. So that to me was one of the most outrageous parts of it. And you've done some work that really exposes this lie. So just walk us through the lie.
Well, this guy really is the great prevaricator. And the Apple statement, first of all, is false on several different levels. First of all, Apple talks about increasing its U.S. purchases from U.S. suppliers by $350 billion. When they talked about investment, they said they were going to increase investment by $30 billion. Actually, they already had $30 billion in the plan, so it's not clear that this isn't just what they were doing anyway. Secondly, you know, the $30 billion qualifies for 100% depreciation allowance under the Trump tax plan, which it didn't before. You know, so the Apple will, by virtue of that fact alone, be able to chop its U.S. corporate taxes in half. And, you know, the third thing that's, which is what my article goes into, is, you know, the tax plan that Trump announced with great fanfare, you know, as a great boon to the middle class and working class, does try to toss some, a little bit of the benefits in the direction of working class people. But more than 83% of the benefits of this tax bill go to the top 1%, even before you take into account the analysis that I did. And that is to look at what happens to the $2.6 trillion offshore that U.S. multinationals like Apple have accumulated and are now allowed to essentially bring back into the United States if they choose to pay the repatriation tax. And, you know, it looks like they already got a deep discount on that, 8 to 15%, depending on what kind of cash holdings they had offshore. In Apple's case, it calculated that it said it would bring back $38 billion based on $252 billion of offshore profits and royalties that it had stashed. And that works out to about 15%. But when you actually look at the fine print in the tax bill, which apparently very few people who voted for it did, and I don't think many Democrats actually did either, you see one paragraph that says that the companies have 8 years to pay this tax, and they don't have to pay any interest on the tax obligation, and they pay it in installments according to a specific plan, which is 8% for 5 years each year, and then 15, 20, 25 for the last 3 years. So meanwhile, under the tax provision, Apple has, going forward, a territorial income tax. So there's basically no tax on offshore income. So they're not actually required to reinvest this money in the United States. They're not required to repatriate it. All they're required to do is to pay the $38 billion in 8 years. And this says to me that if you were really going to profit maximize here for Apple shareholders, what they do is they simply leave the money offshore. They invested it, you know, the kind of 2% yields they've been getting. And when you calculate the net present value of all that, they end up with $258 billion by the year 2025, having basically been given an interest-free loan on the part of the government and zero taxes on the yields that they're going to earn from their offshore investments. So this is a gigantic, case of of misleading the American public about what giant corporations like Apple are paying. I mean, they not only have this minimal, I think, probably zero effective percent tax rate on the offshore profit stash, but they also, going forward, they don't have any income taxes to pay, corporate income taxes on their offshore earnings. And Apple now derives about 67% of their revenues from offshore businesses. So, you know, they're essentially going to get to pay at most, maybe a 10% tax rate on income offshore. Well, that's just going to, compared with the new 21% corporate tax rate on domestic businesses. That's going to give Apple and other multinationals a giant incentive to keep their money offshore, to invest offshore. And it's, you know, just the opposite of creating jobs here.
And again, I speak with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. And his latest article at DC Report is The Apple Tax Giveaway. Well, let's look at the other lie and scam, and that is this $1.5 trillion infrastructure package that he's talking about. There's actually only $200 billion that is real in that, and that is basically U.S. Treasury subsidy for private investors who will then clean up like crazy. And it's based upon a failed model that's already failed in the U.K.
That's right. I mean, if you really want to look at how this works in practice, you look at, first of all, the inventor of the idea was Mussolini in Italy. There's a great article in the 1935 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine called 12 Years of Fascist Finance. And it basically describes how Mussolini was able to pull the rug over the eyes of all the citizens by essentially turning over the operation of public infrastructure to the private sector and paying enormous prices in terms of the leases that they were given to operate the roads and highways and hospitals and schools. The British Conservative Party also implemented a similar kind of disastrous program under the Cameron and May governments called the PFI Initiative, in which they basically licensed schools and hospitals and roads, and even the headquarters building for the British IRS was licensed. It ended up paying lease payments to an offshore company. So, you know, the whole reputation of this kind of public finance initiative is pretty disastrous among economists once you look at the fine print and realize that it's another gigantic handout to the to the private sector. I mean, we could, you know, easily make the stock market rise if we just gave the national parks to the largest corporations, or cut their taxes to zero. And, you know, the fact that the stock market is surging is no evidence that this is in the national interest or is going to benefit ordinary Americans create any jobs.
Yeah, but already, you know, you can't totally write Trump off and the Republicans. And I think Democrats are digging their own grave, thinking that somehow this guy's going to be impeached or the 25th Amendment's going to get rid of this character. He's right when he says the stock market is surging and people's 401ks, so people are looking at their 401ks and thinking, my God, I'm a millionaire. So that's happening. Now, I don't think it's going to happen. I think the bubble's going to burst, but you can't deny there are certain aspects of this sleight of hand going on here, where you give a couple of $1 trillion to the billionaires and they trickle down and give a few bonuses out to people, one-time bonuses, and everybody thinks that we got a booming economy. They're doing.
Well, I think that you can hand out, you can say that, you know, maybe 10% of the benefits of this plan go to ordinary Americans, and you know, pension funds will benefit somewhat, but the true owners of the means of production in this country are still, a tiny fraction at the top. And most of the shareholders of Apple, for example, is 22,500 shareholders of Apple. And, you know, that's it, the individuals. 60% of Apple is owned by 2,500 institutions like Vanguard and BlackRock. You know, so the ownership of stock is just the more you know about it, the more you see how concentrated it is. In any case, there's just, the last time this kind of repatriation tax cut was enacted by Bush back in 2004, what did the major companies do with it? They basically did share buybacks, stockholder buybacks. They didn't create any jobs. In fact, they were laying off jobs. Right now, the market is surging, and I think to a great extent it's because of this tax cut. But it's also feeling very toppy. You know, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen evidence that maybe the stock market has peaked. Frankly, I think Trump inherited an economy that was still recovering. You know, it was, the momentum was established under Obama. The 2.4 million jobs he talks about in the last year is actually less than the previous year. So there's, some concern on the part of investors that looking forward, we're not going to be able to have another year like we just had. And the fundamental point is that this tax cut comes at a point in which we should be trying to fight poverty, should be trying to reduce, the levels of inequality in this country. And this bill ended up doing exactly the opposite. You know, by far the most, I would say it's probably one of the greatest wealth transfers in U.S. history from the public sector to a tiny elite. And, it's a real missed opportunity. I mean, for the $2.6 trillion that's essentially going to go untaxed, we could have made a big dent in the $80 billion a year that we need to, to adjust to climate change for developing countries, to realize the sustainable development goals. There's just a lot of social investments we should be making. And instead, we're essentially cutting deals with the private sector again to handle our infrastructure investments that we should be financing with taxes and public sector borrowing. This is just going to increase the federal deficit by, up to $2 trillion. That's a cost that's going to be transferred to the future, to our grandchildren. And, there's just, in the long run, I think this particular tax measure is going to be identified as one of the most regressive in U.S. corporate history.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, DCReport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. And his latest article at DC Report is The Apple Tax Giveaway. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the healthcare project put forward by Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway that was long on promises and short on details. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry and currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Reducing Healthcare Costs Doesn't Require Bezos, Buffett, Diamond Magic. Every other country already knows how. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
It's good to be back with you, Ian.
And the announcement by Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway that they were teaming up to create a new healthcare system or a partnership was pretty thin on specifics. How much did you learn from it, apart from the fact that you have some serious criticism, which we want to get into, but in general, what did they deliver in terms of specifics?
Well, I would say they delivered a press release, and there are no specifics. I mean, there's some mention of things like, they're going to create a joint venture, an independent joint venture company that will be, from what we can tell, nonprofit, and that it will focus on technology solutions to bringing down or limiting healthcare costs. But that's pretty nebulous, and it's pretty thin gruel as these things go.
So one of the things that I don't understand is I understand that corporate America has for the longest time been concerned about out-of-control healthcare costs for their employees. And at one point, the big three automakers were thinking of moving a lot of their work across the river to plants in Canada that they already have, because the Canadians have a single-payer healthcare system, and that saves these corporations an enormous amount of money, and which, frankly, is one of the best arguments for single-payer, which I'm surprised that corporate America doesn't get behind. But what's to stop corporate America, for example, of enrolling their employees in Kaiser?
Well, nothing, and many corporations do enroll their employees in Kaiser. I mean, my employer offers us Kaiser as an option. Kaiser's really not for everybody, because you have to be within striking distance of a Kaiser hospital if you want to use it, and not everybody, even in Southern California, can say that. Some people don't like Kaiser. Some people think that it's not the best health care. There's some debate about that. It's certainly cheaper, and in many ways it's more efficient, but nothing is preventing them from doing it. Nothing's really preventing the United States from spending half as much as we do per capita or as a percentage of the gross domestic product than we do, except essentially for the political will to make the changes that are necessary. But these changes are not a mystery.
But just going back to the big three automakers wanting to move their production to the plants that they have across the river in Canada, surely that's a signal, isn't it? That, and that was a while back, that they're concerned about their spiraling healthcare costs. Why has it taken so long for them not to? I mean, I think the only encouraging thing that I see from this joint statement by Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway is at least some of these big corporations are getting together to figure out an alternative. Not that, as you point out, the rest of the world has already done that. But what's preventing corporate America from doing what seems obvious, to either get together or lobby for single payer, which is why the big three were moving to Canada, because it saves them an awful lot of money?
Yeah, I think what prevents them from doing that is the same thing that prevents these three companies, Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway, from actually taking the bull by the horns and being more candid about what creates these high prices. They do not want to get involved in the politics of healthcare in the United States, which are very, very messy. And the reason it's the politics are messy here is that we've allowed a lot of interest groups to get very wealthy and to exercise their political power. And we're talking about drug companies and hospital chains and physicians and medical device manufacturers and health insurance companies. They all of these entities have an interest in keeping the system exactly as it is, because they all profit from it, and I would say they all over-profit from it or profiteer from it. I think, you know, Buffett and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan and Jeff Bezos of Amazon, they don't want to get their hands dirty by getting into this sort of political fight. So they're creating the sense that this is all about technology, and that there's some sort of mysterious secret sauce technological fix that will change the American healthcare system in a dramatic way. And I think, I mean, I'll give them the credit to say, you know, maybe they believe that, but it's simply untrue. They're blowing smoke, and the evidence for that is the fact that just over the border in Canada, they spend, these are figures from 2015, in Canada they spend $4,600 per person on health care, whereas in the United States we spend $9,400 per person. There's no technological reason for that sort of discrepancy. The reason is political, and it's an exercise of political power that keeps these prices high. We charge too much. Insurance companies take too much out of the system. Hospitals charge too much. Drug companies charge too much, much more than they really deserve. And when you add all that up, you end up with $9,400 per person spending, as opposed to Canada's figure, or even the average figure among all other industrialized countries, which is $4,900. You know, so we're really talking about 50 to 60% over the entire industrialized world compared to what we spend in the United States. And it's the point I made in this piece is that there's no mystery to this. There's no mystery to how to bring costs down. The way to do it is to cut prices, unit prices. Americans don't use more health care than people in other countries. In fact, in many ways, we use less. We spend less time in the hospital. We get admitted to the hospital at a lower rate. We use about as much in terms of pharmaceuticals as other countries, but we pay twice, three times, four times, maybe five times more than other countries. That's what drives up these costs.
Well, just perhaps, not that I'm justifying Bezos, Buffett and Diamond, their sort of timidity here and the lack of specifics, but they may be being cautious because even though they delivered basically what you say is, Michael, as a press release rather than a plan, Cigna and Anthem both dropped 5% on the market, and CVS and Walgreens declined more than 4%, etc. Some of them also, the pharmacy corporations dropped nearly 7%. So already it sort of rattled the markets a little bit, didn't it, this announcement?
Yes, it did. But I don't think that has anything to do with whether anybody really thinks, you know, has put in the deep thinking to say these guys are going to have the secret. I think it's basically a knee-jerk reaction. I think it will evaporate over the near term. I think what investors in some of these companies are more concerned about is that Amazon and Berkshire, which already has a reinsurance company in the healthcare field, and maybe JP Morgan, will get involved in their industries not as nonprofits, but as profit making entities, and will take some of their business away. I don't think that's very realistic, but look, these are three very big companies. These are three very well-known executives. Amazon certainly has a record of disrupting existing industries. Berkshire is a very smartly run enterprise, really a conglomerate. So I think it's not unreasonable for investors in healthcare to say, well, that now that there may be new entrants into this field who are going to take some of our business away. But I don't think this is really a reflection that people think that these guys are going to have a secret or they're going to figure something out that nobody else knows. I think it's a different phenomenon that accounts for the fact that these stocks went down. And, you know, it's, as I said, I think that that trend will vanish over the next probably just a few days.
Well, without getting into a critique of the State of the Union, which, you know, was extraordinary. Trump, on the one hand, talking about how much he loves dreamers and then basically issuing a kind of racist manifesto about how we want people from Norway in the country. And then the warmongering vis-a-vis North Korea. He clearly wants a war with North Korea. It was just appalling. But what I was most struck by in that speech, and it just mystifies me, and it really makes me question how much the minds of Americans have been warped about healthcare, was when Trump talked about how he's gotten rid of the individual mandate and crippled Obamacare, to this massive applause from the Republicans. Here they are cheering because they have successfully denied their fellow citizens health care. That is not something to cheer about.
No, and of course their attempts to eviscerate the Affordable Care Act, it really strikes at not only the customer protection aspects of the Affordable Care Act and the success that the Affordable Care Act has had in getting insurance to people who didn't have it before, but it undermines a lot of other provisions of the Act that were aimed at changing the ways we pay hospitals and physicians to make it more efficient and to lower those prices. And some of those initiatives that are in the ACA have actually been very successful. And to the extent that Trump and his Republican handmaidens are out there trying to undermine it, they're undermining exactly what we need to get lower prices. But they don't think in those terms. You know, they're looking ahead to the taillights of the car that's right in front of them, and they see these all of this in strictly partisan and ideological terms. So they don't know anything about health care. I mean, Trump doesn't know anything about health care. The average Republican in Congress, he doesn't know anything about health care. It's a complicated field, and there are a lot of moving parts, and you actually have to spend some time studying it to know what you're doing. So they're basically taking the easy way out.
Right, but to have a mindset in a country, at least to have the ability to find receptive number of Americans who think that it's a good thing to deny health care rather than to make it affordable, is just mind-boggling. And that's what I kind of get my head up.
I don't think they have successfully done that. I think what we saw during this long campaign of theirs to repeal Obamacare is that Obamacare actually had a majority of Americans in support, and those Americans came out in force, and that's why Congress was unable to actually do a straight-up repeal of Obamacare last year. And what they eventually had to do is do this sort of sub rosa backdoor repeal by eliminating the individual mandate. And, you know, as I've written in the last few days, it's that very well is likely to result in 30% increases in premiums in 2019 for millions of Americans. And you know, the chickens will come home to roost. But when they had a full-on, straight-up, frontal attack on Obamacare, they got an enormous amount of pushback, and they failed. So I think most Americans, certainly Americans who've had experience with trying to get health insurance in the individual market, are very much in favor of the consumer protections that were in the Affordable Care Act and want them to stay.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hilsig, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues, and his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Reducing Healthcare Costs Doesn't Require Bezos, Buffett, Diamond Magic. Every other country already knows how. But I still don't understand why. I mean, again, it's a bit like what Lakoff up there in Berkeley talks about, the lack of framing on the left, where the right is able to frame things like death tax and stuff like that, or tax relief, which if you're not in favor of tax relief, you're therefore in favor of tax pain. And, you know, pro-life versus pro-choice. Many ways arguments are framed detrimentally. The net neutrality is another one that's a really amorphous loser of a title for a cause. And I don't understand why the single payer, of course, is yet another one. It doesn't say anything. And is there a way for the advocates of single payer to make the simple case that insurance companies are an unnecessary layer between the caregiver and the patient? And if you pool your money, then you don't need them. They're kind of like the mafia. They don't bring anything to the table except expense, and the markup in expense equals their overhead, and this is completely economically unsustainable. So to me, that gets at the heart of it. As long as you're nibbling at the edges like the Clintons tried to do and like Obama did, you're never going to get these people out of the way. And that's the problem, is the insurance companies are the worst people to be in the healthcare business because they're only interested in healthy people. That's where they make their money. They're not interested in sick people because that's how they lose money.
Well, I think I sympathize with your perplexity, Ian, and to a certain extent I share it. But I think you have to think in terms of sort of the ground level politics of healthcare. And I think what's most important to keep in mind is that most people, the vast majority of people, have very little interaction with the healthcare system. And that's because the normal default condition of most people is health. They're healthy. 20% of the population accounts for 80% of spending on healthcare treatments. And that's an immutable figure that's always been there and is always true and I think is inescapable. And as a result, the average person really does not deal with his health insurance company very often. And even more rarely in a way that's frustrating. And that would be, you have a major claim, maybe you have a condition that's hard to figure out, then you might have a lot of trouble dealing with your health insurance company. For the most part, people have a fairly smooth relationship. I mean, we don't think of it that way because most of the stories we hear are horror stories, but they represent a very small portion of the population. And as a result of that, when you tell people we are going to change the way this works, most people get nervous because they think it works okay for them. And I think that's what accounts for the fact that single payer, in theory, is popular among the American public. But when you get down and start talking about the details, it loses a lot of popularity because people have to start thinking about, how is this going to work for me? Am I going to lose my coverage? Is it going to be different? Am I going to have to pay for it differently? Am I going to have to jump through different hoops? All of these things that are very uncertain really militates against the simple framing. It's much easier to say, there's one thing that doesn't work about this system, so the whole system stinks, and that's the Republican approach. So it's going to take time, I think, to really get this message across. And I think what's going to have to happen is that things are going to have to get worse before they get better, and the Republicans are doing their best to make things get worse. And eventually, there will be a reaction. I think single payer is politically more palatable today than it was a year ago, but it still needs a lot more work and a lot more support. So it's not obvious and it's not easy.
Well, Michael Hilsinger, thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hilsinger, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal in Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Reducing Healthcare Costs Doesn't Require Bezos, Buffett, Diamond Magic. Every other country already knows how. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye for now. I'm